This week on The Futurists, Kim Stanley Robinson.
There are going to be people fighting tooth and nail to wreck the world. And unconsciously, that's what's going on there is discussed in ministry. It's the Götterdämmerung. It's the goddamning of the world, although that's a mistranslation. If I have to change my ways and lose political power, I'm taking everybody down with me.
Welcome back to The Futurist. This week we have a special guest, Kim Stanley Robinson, multi-award-winning science fiction author, and a fascinating journey we've had in terms of his books and his writings and his process. Stan, one of the things that I'm very interested in, obviously, I do a lot of work in futurism in banking. And I'm very interested in, you know, this concept of late stage capitalism and the fact that we are running into some of the limitations of the capitalist model. And you could argue that climate change itself is it's not a bug of capitalism. It's sort of a feature. It's an outcome of the way we think about resources and so forth in that model. But you argued for a very different type of economic philosophy to emerge on Mars. And it started with some very simple practicalities about how do you, make Mars as survivable as possible, as quickly as possible. And then, you know, what sort of economy would emerge in that location or in that setting? And, I've heard it referred to as eco-economics. I've heard it referred to as eco-poetics and so forth. But you've actually done quite a bit of work in sort of turning this into, I wouldn't say economic theory, but at least into some research papers and so forth. And others have done that. But take us through sort of your thinking, both from the Ministry for the Future and from the Mars Trilogy, in terms of why you think that this conversation about our economic structure and our philosophical drivers needs to sort of mature.
Yeah, I'll give it a try. And I want to state right from the start that the economic discussions in the Mars Trilogy are very, very different than the economic discussions in Ministry for the Future. Mm-hmm. Because they're addressing two different historical moments and also literary opportunities. The Mars Trilogy is a utopian novel, and like all the famous utopias, it starts with a break so that the people who are instituting the new political economy can have a fresh start. And that's not something that's available to us in real world history. So utopias always exist as thought experiments. If you could design it from scratch, what would you do differently to make it more just, more sustainable over the long haul, et cetera? That is what the Mars Trilogy was up to. They got to Mars, they were being run like Antarctica. It was a scientific space, a study space. There wasn't money, there wasn't an economy. Nobody was making a profit. They were making a living by doing what they came to do with outside sources of funding. And then they were also growing their own food and creating their own economy. So they're very interested in that book in the gift economies of primitive societies, although that's the wrong word. That's the word from the 90s, from early Paleolithic pre-capitalist societies, maybe even pre-agricultural societies. These gift economies are strange. Also, all kinds of anarchist, syndicalist, socialist, people like Murray Bookchin or Kropotkin or Hazel Henderson, the American economist, Joan Robinson from England. There was an obviously leftist solution, a communal eco-socialism that was being invented on Mars, but from scratch. So they were free to write their own constitution. They were free to make the planet Mars a citizen with rights. And the costs and benefits of terraforming Mars were taken into account in the economy itself. Interesting and applicable metaphorically to our situation on Earth, but not directly applicable, because here we are now, when I say 2020, when I finished Ministry for the Future pre-pandemic, but stuck in late global capitalism, neoliberalism, the nation-state system, these things aren't going away just because you have a good idea. And yet we are in a global climate crisis. We are wrecking the biosphere. It's going to start a mass extinction event, and it's getting super dangerous. If we continue on the course we're on, we could crash the biosphere in ways that wreck civilization. Life on Earth will go on happily. Things will evolve. After extinctions, there will be empty ecological niches. New creatures will come into being. And 25 million years later, everything will look fine. But we could crash humanity's civilization and us be some unhappy little remnant group scrabbling around in the ruins trying to make sense of it all. That could happen, and it's bad. So now economics becomes a matter of facing up to reality, using the system that we've got and tweaking it to make it sane and applicable to our problem. That's a whole different kettle of fish. And that's what the Ministry of Future is about. And so maybe I'll leave it at that, just to set the grounds for why the two are so different.
You know, one of the sense I get when I read that book is the sense of futility, that human effort is always going to be confounded by other human efforts, that it's almost impossible to harmonize the activity of humans. And so the sense of optimism seems to be missing in the Ministry for the Future. It's more, it's a sense of frustration. And do you write these books with a sense of, you know, didacticism? Are you trying to give us examples, positive and negative, about how we might want to act in the future? Or is it more just a meditation?
No, they're didactic for sure. I mean, all art is trying to reorient your view of reality. It's not a mirror, it's a hammer. So that's fine. I recognize that when other artists claim to be pure in a way that they don't do that, they're just some kind of mirror. That's their game. They can play it. I feel they are deceived and not making use of the tool that they have. For me, I'm writing with a political purpose, and I'm also trying to make an entertaining work of art. The two are by no means in conflict with each other. They energize each other. So that said, I wrote Ministry for the Future in 2019, and it was a much darker time then than now, strangely, but truly. Before the pandemic, we were ignoring climate change. Donald Trump was president. It was an ugly time. I was angry. I thought, we are not going to cope with this. And so the future portrayed in Ministry for the Future, although it's a best case scenario from 2019, already 4 years later, I'm going to say we can do better than the future I portrayed in Ministry for the Future. There doesn't have to be that violence. There doesn't have to be that discord. And I'm seeing a world that is absolutely electrified, and luckily that's physical as well as metaphorical, to fight the climate change problem by decarbonizing our technology systems, our infrastructures, as fast as possible. And it's become a project for business, academia, and government, and hopefully the public at large also. And what we're seeing now is rapid response and, of course, intense pushback. So, yes, there are going to be people fighting tooth and nail to wreck the world. And unconsciously, that's what's going on there is discussed in Ministry. It's the Götterdämmerung. It's the goddamning of the world, although that's a mistranslation. If I have to change my ways and lose political power, I'm taking everybody down with me. Because I'm right, and I hate everybody who's not me. And so that narcissistic, destructive response is out there in spades, and they're pretty powerful, but they are not the majority, and their power can be dispossessed. They can be, their power can be taken away by something as simple as tax reform. So I feel better now about our chances. I'll put it this way. There's a sentence in Ministry that says the 2030s were zombie years. Well, that is not going to happen. That sentence is flatly wrong. The zombie years were probably 2016 to 2020, or 2000, or 1990 to 2020. Those were the zombie years. The 2020s are actually going to be a galvanized, intensely conflicted, but also very busy years trying to come to grips with this problem.
Yeah, I agree.
So where do you think all this is going to head next? Do you think there's a possibility that people might get together and, you know, support a new system where we put merit first and science first versus our current system where it's, you know, more actors and, you know, more interesting people every year getting into politics?
Well, that's the battle of our time. Nobody can call that. I definitely do not claim to be a prophet. Everybody's just analyzing the situation and running trajectories forward into the future and saying this might happen, that might happen. I'm going to say we're in a world where already science rules. Everybody, when they're sick and scared for their lives, they run to a scientist. So even people who will work hard to wreck science, when they're scared for their life, they run to a scientist, which is what their doctor is, which is what medicine is, and they cry baby and say, please save me if you can. And the scientist will say, well, look, it's not magic here. It's science. You know, sorry, but you're going to die. We don't have your problem figured out. Or they're going to say, we're going to poison you to within an inch of your life, even though you don't have symptoms, but you're scared. And if our poison works, then you might survive. And people say, give me the poison. That's trust in science. Big time.
Yeah.
I mean, really big time. So you take that out there like a hammer and you hit people with it. You already believe in science. We're already in a world created by science, technology, engineering, and medicine and mathematics, by STEM. So the rest of society is a way of choosing which STEM products to enact and which ones to ignore and try to pick the best ones for survivability, because 8 billion people is way more people than we've ever had to deal with before. Keeping them all alive is a spectacular act of cooperation. So, and of STEM products and ingenuity. And of course, law is a technology. And as I said, language, these are the technologies that are the softwares of the system. And that's where the battle that you were talking about, Katie, of between, you know, the, what can I call it? The soap opera. On the, that culture puts out a soap opera and attempts to tell you that that's the important part of reality. And that even includes our presidential elections, which are more soap opera than science. And so there is a battle for attention, for money, of where to put it and what really matters.
Right on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very interesting. You know, I do want to talk about the, you know, in Ministry for the Future, you have this event, you know, let's call it a Pearl Harbor event that sort of catalyzes action, which is this massive heat wave in India. And, you know, looking at COP28, you know, and the influence that fossil fuel corporations had over that, there is a bit of interplay. I mean, you talk about the transnational corporations in the the Mars series, but you know, you do have this interplay of sort of the role of these big corporations and so forth as well. But you know, for real, combined consensus based action on the climate, do you think we need that sort of Pearl Harbor event like the India heat wave that you talk about at the start of Ministry?
Well, I hope not. And what I want to say is there's two things going on with that first chapter of Ministry for the Future, a rather brutal thing, the worst thing I ever wrote, and I hope the worst thing I ever write, that I'm terrified that might really happen. We're trembling on the brink of heat waves that will kill everybody that hasn't got electricity running. And that's scary in a deep way. And one of the hottest wet bulb temperatures ever recorded was outside of Chicago. So it isn't like it's just the tropics. It's everywhere where heat and humidity combine often, like the Midwest and the American South and so many places on this earth. So on the one hand, I'm terrified. On the other hand, it was like a literary punch on the nose. Like, wake up, people. And you have to remember, I wrote this before the pandemic, which was a literal punch on the nose. But in my case, a figurative punch on the nose. We're in this kind of danger, folks. And once you know that kind of danger exists, and we've had 2 years of incredible climate catastrophes all over the world, I think you don't need a Pearl Harbor, that we're having little World Trade Centers and little and not so little wars happening. Russia on Ukraine, that's a carbon war. That's a climate change war. And the same is probably true of the Israel-Gaza conflict. These are maybe pre-existing problems and conflicts between people, massively exacerbated by lack of water, by lack of food, by temperature changes. In other words, heat. And so I don't think we need the Pearl Harbor because we've already had, we're already in response mode.
Yeah.
If something like the first chapter of Ministry were to happen, we wouldn't say, oh gosh, I didn't know that could happen. We would say, oh my God, we didn't even react, even though we knew this could happen. So in essence, I think we're past that. I think we're in emergency response mode now. I've been spending 3 years of my life doing nothing but talking to people about this. And I mean at all levels of government and right down to small town gatherings of individual citizens. And everybody's aware, everybody's trying to think of things to do. And this includes the international agencies that are trying to coordinate the response. So, I mean, COP28 was actually a pretty productive meeting for getting some real results from the nations who are working on it. The host country doesn't matter. They are not crucial. And in fact, the United Arab Emirates are one of the more virtuous of the petrostates in terms of trying to work their way out of it to some post-carbon burning world. In fact, UAE and Colombia in South America are two of those virtuous petrostates who are saying to the world, help us transition to an economy that doesn't depend on us selling and burning fossil fuels. We need help. We want help. We're going to pay our way out of it. These are two different situations. We should be helping both countries, one with support and technologies, the other with money and support and technologies. I'm speaking of Colombia. So we don't need the Pearl Harbor. We're already in the war.
Provoke Media is proud to sponsor, produce, and support the Futurist podcast. Provoke.fm is a global podcast network and content creation company with the world's leading fintech podcast and radio show, Breaking Banks. And of course, its spin-off podcasts, Breaking Banks Europe, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific, and the Fintech Five. But we also produce the official Finovate podcast, Tech on Reg, Emerge Everywhere, the podcast of the Financial Health Network, and Next Gen Banker. For information about all our podcasts, go to provoke.fm or check out Breaking Banks, the world's number one fintech podcast and radio show.
Earlier, we spoke about environment as a kind of protagonist or maybe an antagonist in your stories. And then Brett raised the question at the beginning of this segment about economic drivers and corporations as entities. And those are also characters in some of your stories as well. There's one more factor I would love to spend the last time on here in this interview. That is about governance. And personally, I'm concerned because it doesn't look to me that we have a governance mechanism. We don't have a ministry for the future right now in the world. And one of the things you could say about all the conflicts around the world, whether they're economic or military conflicts, is that they are at some level a battle over resources, control of resources, whether it's water, land, or anything else. We don't seem to have a better mechanism for sorting that out than to have a conflict. Now, in your perspective, do you see progress being made there or do you see us stuck? I mean, right now, if you look at the headlines in the newspaper each day, it seems like we're mired in conflicts that seem to be unsolvable. How do you maintain optimism? And what is your perspective about governance this decade?
Well, thank you for that, Rob. It's an interesting question because it's the question, I think. We're in a global problem, a set of global problems. They're being called the polycrisis. That's a good name for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even need to list them because people know the elements of the polycrisis. And then we're in a nation state system, which is a zero sum game where if you win, I lose. That's the nation state system. And then capitalism, the rich take as much as they can and let the rest of us go hang. These two systems are very poorly designed for the problem that we're facing. So what happens with governance? Well, there is the UN. There's the International Maritime Organization. I mean, I could make a long list. I mentioned the IMO because they recently said we're going to make 30% of the oceans off limits to fishing and all container ships have to use cleaner fuel than they're using. And that started to happen. So international organizations are not completely toothless. They are weak, they're disorganized, and they come out of a post-World War II moment where, again, that was a nation-state system where the U.S. and its allies said, we're going to run the world from now on. It'll be better for everybody if there's a policeman. And most of the international organizations have that historical origin. But now they're looking around and saying, geez, the world is going down. World Trade Organization says to itself, let's make trade rules more just and sustainable than they've ever been. IMO says, let's clean up container ships, which is one reason that 2023 was the hottest year on record ever, because for one thing, container ships stopped burning so many aerosols into the atmosphere. We cleaned up the air. It's gotten hotter. This is the kind of problem that we're in. So the governance is crucial. And what I've seen, and I've now talked to officials at the EU and at the World Bank and in the Pentagon and at the OECD and at the WTO, and it goes on and on and on like this. They're frustrated. They want to do more. They're uncertain whether their nation state members will support them doing more, will allow themselves to be policed and regulated and governed. But everybody's feeling somewhat desperate that they're kind of kicking the ball upstairs. This is one direction to the international organizations saying, please make us do the stuff we know we need to do, because our politicians will be fighting the country next door or putting up the guard, the fence, build a wall, like the countries in Europe, like Hungary, who are saying, look, nobody gets to come in here anymore. The anti-immigrant movement. All these things are happening. In other words, a fight between nation state tribalism and an international global point of view that says, look, we've got global problems that we've got to solve together. So governance is one of the crux points where the battle is ongoing between an older style that is more selfish and a newer style where you actually have to trust people on the other side of the world. Hard to do, but not impossible.
Well, you have to make room for them as well. And that's part of the problem. You can boil this down on an individual level, not just a nation state, but even on the individual level, we're being asked to give up something, and people don't easily give up things. People don't want to buy a smaller car or use the air conditioning less or live in a smaller home or make room for an eco-refugee in their neighborhood. This is a big ask for a lot of people. And so we'd love somebody else to do it. And we say, gee, those displaced people, they ought to make room for them someplace else on the planet. But you don't really see people opening their doors and welcoming that, or being willing to make those kinds of cuts in their own life, except maybe with the exception of electric vehicles. You know, we are seeing people adopt that, and that's an expensive choice.
Maybe electric vehicles, because you want to still have your autonomy of your car, and it doesn't have to be a big car. That's just a flagrant statement, like lighting your cigars with $100 bills to show that you're rich and stupid. Big cars are unnecessary. Europeans prove that. But electrifying and also welcoming strangers into your neighborhood, that happens. So you can, we're in a conflict. We're in a glass, you can say the glass is half full or the glass is half empty. Some problems are false problems. Let's talk about immigration or eco-migrants. The flat truth is most people are too poor to migrate. You cannot walk from India to New York, and you have to pay your way there. So middle-class people can escape their failing country, like in Syria. Most people will die in place. This is the thing. If you were realistic about it, it's a sad truth. Most people cannot escape their climate, their country. Migrants are privileged people that have the wherewithal to pay their way to escape. So this somewhat of a false problem that is being waved as a red flag to make people scared. So this is like a right-wing scare flag. Oh my God, poor people are going to come and join your village. In towns in Maine, when that actually happens, in a small dribble of middle-class people from climate-damaged countries, they often get welcomed in. They often get incorporated. And big urban centers want their labor. So the whole immigration problem is somewhat of a false problem compared to the carbon burn problem. Electrification. I will agree with this. Nobody wants to give up comforts. But if you get your comforts in a clean way, it feels more stylish. It feels more virtuous. You feel like you can enjoy it without any sense of guilt or privilege. Like, hey, technology allows me this. Hooray, technology. So although I always point to the technologies called law and language and justice, it's also true that heat pumps are better than HVAC systems, et cetera, et cetera. That actual mechanical technologies, as they get better, they allow the possibility that all humans alive will live at adequacy. And that also relies on, you know, tax policies, on suppressing the richness of the rich and their power. There are all kinds of political elements involved in this utopian view of things, but the potential is there for a really positive future coming into being if we make it so. So the fear narratives have to be defended stoutly against. You have to call bullshit on the bullshit, and you go on from there.
Right. You know, there's a common theme in sci-fi where there's the, let's say, the 1% building these lower Earth orbit casinos, hotels, you know, habitats that are up there and beautiful, right? And then everyone left on Earth is just, you know, fighting amongst each other and living in, you know, with robots terrorizing them, and they just have to work to, you know, produce materials for the 1% that live up in the dream habitat, right? Now, what are your thoughts about these types of projects? Is there any chance that, you know, what if something like this theoretically happened? Do you see people pushing back? Would they prevent something like this from happening? Or would corporations somehow be involved in creating such a scenario?
Well, it's a beautiful scenario because it's already happened. Okay. Mm-hmm. In low Earth orbit, that's your gated community. That's your island off of New Zealand. Science fiction very often is a metaphor for the way things are now. It's one of its chief powers is to give you an image that looks scientifically plausible, but also crazily over the top. And then you realize, but wait, things are like that already. And so the Hunger Games, Elysium, the movie one example of the genre you described. These are great science fiction stories. District 9, that goes on like that. The stories of the 1%, most vampire stories are about the 1%. Most zombie stories are about the precariat, trying to cope with their loss of security. These are all science fiction metaphors. They're symbols, they're imagery, they're literature at its finest. So that they're a mirror to our time, but a distorting mirror, a funhouse mirror, like in a carnival, where certain aspects are exaggerated and going, damn, I didn't know we had such a big, stupid head. But that's us. That's just a little bit distorted by the funhouse mirror. So yeah, I am still a huge fan of science fiction's ability to give us images of the way things already are now and shock us by that. So even my Mars trilogy is an image of what we got to do to make a humanity fit into its planet. And it just so happens that the real planet is Earth rather than Mars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, Stan, sorry, Katie, you go ahead.
No, let's head on.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say we're running out of time, and I'm conscious of the fact you've got a hard stop at the top of the hour, but I will maybe ask you one final question. If you're looking out to 2050 or 2100, you know, what makes you most optimistic about the future of humanity?
I'm amazed at what I've learned in the last 3 years about the sheer amount of human time and energy and money that is being applied to this polycrisis that we're in. In 2019, I thought we were behind the curve. That was partly my own ignorance. And that was partly because the pandemic had not yet smacked us on the nose and taught us that the biosphere can kill you and can wreck your life. And now people are acting in a way that's concerted across the board. So I'm meeting with people in businesses. They want to make successful green businesses. I'm meeting with people in government. They want to make successful green regulatory systems. I'm meeting with people in academics. In academia, they want to study and make institutes. They want to create the new ideas that will fuel the new technologies and doing the research without regard to profit. And I'm meeting members of the 1% who are saying, look, it's stupid that I have this much money. How can I spend it in green ways and even give it away? Let's not worry about profit anymore. Once you've got your billion, this is a ridiculous concern. I would like to do good in the world because there are very few villains out there. There are some, and they're probably in their own lights, they're heroes in their own lights. It's interesting to try to understand them and not demonize them. But what encourages me about 2050 and 2100 is there is a palpable sense of dread, not quite panic, but dread, like if we don't fix this problem, civilization crashes. And then what are people going to say about us later, you know, caught up in their dark ages and their hovels?
Yeah.
Looking back, these people knew what they could do. They had such powerful technologies and they didn't do it. People want to do the right thing. They're trying to figure out within our somewhat stupidified political systems and economic system, how can we do the right thing right now using the tools that we have at hand? And this is a widespread response. My encounter with you guys is like encounter 530 since Ministry for the Future came out. And they have all been interesting and educational for me. So I can see maybe I'm in a point position because of Ministry for the Future, although this is not unusual or difficult because everybody's reading the same, well, not the same, but everybody's having a huge information flux coming into their brain. And if you sort it right, you can see the energy. You can see that the crisis is acknowledged as a crisis and that we might have the tools to cope with it. So nobody can predict the future because it all could all go smash if we do things wrong. And that would be a dismal fate. But it also could, we could squeak through the 21st century with, you know, without a mass extinction event. So that's my new low bar for utopia. You get through the 21st century without a mass extinction event.
It reminds me of the David Brin's point. We have a chance. We still have a chance.
Yeah,
he was thrilled to sort of say that.
Yeah.
David is good on these issues.
Yeah, he is. And he's got some opinions too. Stan, it's been fantastic. I've really enjoyed the conversation. I hope it's not our only time we get to interview you. But for those that are interested in the work you're doing and you know, the sort of groundswell that comes from books like Ministry for the Future and so forth, how can people stay in touch with what you're doing and how can we help?
Oh gosh. Everybody is helping in their own way. There are local green causes you can join. I mean, I'm on my local village council. I'm joined with Cool Davis, and every town on earth has little causes you can join. As for me, I'm writing a nonfiction book about Antarctica, so I will retell all the great Antarctic stories and also tell the new story of the groups of people who are studying, can we slow those big glaciers down so they don't slide into the ocean so that we don't have grotesque sea level rise? And so I'm having my fun doing the best I can. And I've got to say, I have this sense of enormous energy of everybody is engaged. And I know that that's somewhat a perceptual error. That's the kind of people I'm running into. But yeah, there's a lot of them. So let's hope for the best.
Well, indeed. Great. Kim Stanley Robinson, thank you very kindly for joining us on The Futurist this week. And for folks who are listening, there's one thing I want to say. I just want to share one more thought. We've talked a lot about your fictional works on this show today, but I want to draw attention to your most recent work, which is nonfiction. It's a memoir of sorts. And if you're interested in a personal experience of transcendence in the environment, then I strongly recommend considering the new book that that Stan has written. It is The High Sierra, a love story. And I'm halfway through right now. I'm enjoying the heck out of it. I spent time in the Sierras as well, and so I can identify with much of what you've written, though I haven't taken 100 trips there as you have. But if you're interested in Stan's inspiration, and his own personal experience of transcendence at 12,000 feet or higher, then by all means, I strongly recommend the book. It's beautifully written, and it gives me a great deal of insight into your other work. So thanks very much for joining us. And of course, thanks to my co-hosts, Katie and Brett, and the crew at Provoke Media that make the show possible each week. Kevin Hirschhorn, our engineer, Elizabeth Severance, our producer, and everyone at Provoke, and of course, our audience. We are so grateful for the listeners. We enjoy hearing from you. We enjoy your comments on social media. We are happy with the tweets and the shares and all the other attention this is getting. We certainly hope you'll share this episode with your friends. Each week, we'll be bringing back another expert on the future for you. And until then, we will see you. Over to you, Brett.
In the future.
Let me say... let me say briefly, thank you, Rob, for that. And thank you, Katie. Thank you, Brett. And Brett, I'd be very happy to come back on the show. Maybe give it some months and I'll come back with news, because things keep happening.
If you've got a new book coming out or something like that, let's absolutely do that.
That'd be great.
Thanks very much, Stan. Wonderful to meet you.
All right. I'm out of here.
Ciao.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's it for The Futurists this week. If you liked the show, we sure hope you did. Please subscribe and share it with the people in your community. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. That really helps other people find the show. And you can ping us anytime on Instagram and Twitter at Futurist Podcast for the folks that you'd like to see on the show or the questions that you'd like us to ask. Thanks for joining. And as always, we'll see you in the future.